Welcome to DC Podcasts, the Watchmen podcast, your number one source for all things relating to HBO's Watchmen series coming this October. Today we will be probing the outer limits of Alan Moore's Watchmen comic book series by investigating the godlike figures of Dr. Manhattan and Adrian Veidt. We'll be delving into the history, we'll be delving into the rich lore behind Alan Moore's creation of these characters, and we'll be trying to answer the fundamental question, what's a king to a god?
Nice. This is the one to listen to, guys. This is the part. We all have very many big opinions.
Yeah. I'm excited. I am playing narrator today.
So I think we decided that we were going to start off talking about Dr. Manhattan, and we should start where we start with all of the characters by going back to their Charlton Comics roots. I think Tony has some factoids to share with us.
Yes. So basically in the 1960s, the first Captain Atom was created by Joe Gill and Steve Ditko. His name was Alan Atom. And for like, I want to say, because I read through that Silver Age, his self-titled series, and it's about like 12, 13 issues long. And I was really, when I started reading it, like, well, I'll get into some plot stuff later, but when I started reading it, I felt it was actually kind of boring. Like, I've read a lot of Silver, well, I don't want to say a lot, but I've read several Silver Age series. I read Legion Superheroes, some Flash, some Green Lantern, some X-Men. So, you know, this is not my first Silver Age series. And I can get into Silver Age comics sometimes. I know people kind of hate on them, but I can get into it. And when I was reading Captain Atom, I was like, this is not good. But I kept reading it for, you know, archival purposes, just, you know, so I could say something. And, oh, by the way, this whole thing is in the public domain, so you can, like, just kind of Google it, and you'll be able to read it if you desire. But I started reading it, and it was kind of, you know, bleh. And really, what I, like, I guess the main point of it is really the character, his origin is that he was a USAF Air Force kind of captain in that, and got caught in an explosion, and he got atomized. And everyone thought he was dead for a little while, but then he pulled himself together because that's his powers. And he's Captain Atom now, and he can... Yeah. So basically, like, the first half of the book is kind of mediocre in that way. Like, it's very, like, by-the-numbers kind of sci-fi hero stuff. And it's really, like, not just sci-fi hero, but, like, spaceman kind of sci-fi hero. Like, he fought some aliens a little bit, and that kind of stuff. But around specifically issue 82, I was, at this point, I was like, okay, I'm just going to get through it and so I can talk about it. And then I get to 82 and it has Nightshade on the cover. I was like, oh, my girl from Suicide Squad. And so I read it. And then, I don't think he came on at 82, but the writer changed to David Kaler. I hope I'm saying that correctly. And on 80, I noticed his name on 82 because I went back to check. And that issue was really good. Like, I mean, it's still, you know, within the dates, you know, it's Silver Age. It's written a specific way, but it felt like it had, like, a good plot and all that. And that kind of set up, like, the relationship between Nightshade and Captain Atom. And, of course, you can right away remember that Silk Spectre is partly, not as heavily as some of the others, but partly based on Nightshade. Of course, Captain Atom inspired Dr. Manhattan. So you got that direct tie to Watchmen in that way. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not just me that noticed the change in quality, because I read the letters columns in the next issue. And everyone was like, hey, that was really good. Like, and of course, you had, like,
see, old school Twitter.
Yes. And even so, you even had, like, the, you know, the dude bro saying, hey, you really had to bring a woman into this book. He couldn't just stay solo. And, you know, like.
Wait, did they really say that? That, like, you had to bring. Even men.
Yeah. I mean, like, I don't want to say old timey, because, I mean, it was a while ago, but old timey sort of language to sound like new
people. Old timey language.
They may have been 12 year olds at that time, not just acting like them. So.
So, like, I mean, it was, the book really improved at that point, and from there, then issue 8, well, okay, when he was introduced, he had basically just a red and yellow costume, and it was, like, a regular, like, superhero costume. On issue 84, they inject metal under his skin, so if you've seen, like, modern Captain Atom, where he's just fully silvery, that's where that part comes from. He still had the red and the yellow, but it was, at that point, you can kind of see, okay, he's becoming less human in a way, which is interesting, because we know what Moore did with Dr. Manhattan in that context. And really, like, it's just, I mean, they begin to bring in more Charlton Comics elements, like Nightshade shows up again, and Blue Beetle has his backup story in the book, and I want to say that might be, like, the introduction of Ted Kord, actually. I did not pay that much attention to it, to be honest, but I think that's when he was introduced, or at least being really heavily promoted, and they have him and, well, Captain Atom and Nightshade, they have this team up against a villain couple, Punch and Julie, which are kind of like a non-problematic Joker and Harley villain clown.
Maybe a less. I don't know, a non-problematic.
Yeah,
if you show up in, they did make a big appearance, I believe, in Doomsday Clock, in one of the earlier issues. Not that we're going to talk about Doomsday Clock. We'll save that for another time.
But you can kind of see, even though it was a short series, you can kind of see, like, a lot of the elements that reused for Watchmen, and kind of like, or at least you could see where Moore kind of got some stuff, like, okay, I see his humanity changing and what could be going on in that character's head at the time. Even though it wasn't explored, it's still kind of, I can understand how he got Dr. Manhattan out of this concept. And yeah, that's pretty much what I got.
So and Dr. Man, I mean, sorry, Dr. Man. So Captain Atom came out at a time, I think we were talking a little bit about some of these other, obviously that was an impressive amount of reading that you did for a book that maybe was not up to some of the rest of the writing.
Seriously.
used to. But, and, I mean, it was kind of like Alan Moore talks about it as like, you know, it's like, well, if I could, I'd get this. And if I couldn't, I'd get that. If I couldn't, I'd get this. And then if there was nothing else, I'd get Carlton. Comics, right? So that was great, but there was a few other characters at the time. I think, you know, we talked earlier off the air about Nuklo, and what was the other one? Was it Solar?
Solar, yeah.
And they, I mean, this was, you know, we're coming still fairly close off of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and, you know, nuclear power becoming a thing, and people still being not great about it. And, you know, just like, you know, where Superman takes the Ubermensch, and, you know, what was going on in Germany at the time, and kind of turns it on its head to make, you know, the perfect man is the hero. In this case, we're taking nuclear power and making it your friend. Kind of, you know, now this is a hero, not the enemy. And it was kind of like a zeitgeist, and that you just saw a lot of nuclear this, nuclear that, that nuclear power was the new magic going around. And it was kind of, it was just a big theme. And Captain Atom was one of those characters. Do we want to go and talk about Manhattan, or do we want to just do the background? Like, so let's get through the Carlton part and then come back.
We should do the Carlton part and then go into Manhattan, because that'll tie the two in together.
Okay.
I mean, and then, like, you could talk about Osterman. Osterman in and of himself is not necessarily like, he's more exciting when he's Dr. Manhattan, but he's literally sort of the reverse of Superman to me. So I'll save that for when we get to Manhattan. But yeah, we should.
Well, you can also say, did he even survive the accident? Is Manhattan? Mm-hmm. We'll get there. All right, so everybody knows that I have a love for mildly misunderstood geniuses. The early Pete Cannon. So Pete Cannon was a character called Thunderbolt, right? So he was originally, you know, so originally what had happened was that the creator, Pete Morsi, wanted to buy a character named Daredevil. Now, Daredevil, this is not Daredevil, the same Daredevil that's Marvel's Daredevil, although that Daredevil was loosely based on this original Daredevil as well. But he wasn't able to do that, so he decided to create his own kind of version of that original Daredevil character, which is a whole nother podcast. But you know, he has so he ends up with a similar suit to that Daredevil and similar, you know, powers to that Daredevil. Though his the original Daredevil's powers were kind of not really undefined, although I think he couldn't hear or couldn't speak, and like it was kind of it did have some similarities in that. Marvel Daredevil can't see, whereas this Daredevil, I think, originally couldn't speak, but found other ways to obviously fight for justice. The original, so the story of Thunderbolt is that Pete Cannon was kind of went with his parents, who were kind of Doctors Without Borders, doctors, real heroes, and they died fighting. I think it's a bad guy named Black Plague, not the actual Black Plague. And so he was, but the gist of it is he was orphaned in a Himalayan monastery, which is, again, we talked last week about Orientalism. This is, you know, off the charts, you know, Oriental fetishism. He meditates for years and gets himself to peak mental and physical perfection. And then, you know, he starts to, you know, go up the levels within the monastery, and he gets so enlightened that he gets access to these scrolls that nobody gets access to, because, you know, the white guy obviously is so much better at meditation than any of the people of the Himalayas. Put that aside, the little blonde white boy. This is a big thing that, you know, one of the things that if anybody is a can we just Agents of Atlas fan? You know that Robert Grayson from that book, who was Marvel Boy, and then later becomes the Uranian, is a similar thing where he is the son of a German scientist who somehow makes his way to Uranus. I'm pronouncing it that way on purpose, and. He dies on the way, and his son is raised by the Iranians, and he comes back and shares his knowledge with the world and helps people. This was a similar type character, except in the Himalayas. He has a sidekick named Taboo, who is an extremely racist caricature, but still...
His name was Taboo? The sidekick's name was Taboo?
Yes.
Oh, God.
It was with a U instead of a O, but yes. And their dynamic was, it was kind of like a Haji and Johnny Quest dynamic, but there would be a problem, and Haji would be like, we have to help those poor people. And Peter Cannon would be like, the problems of humanity don't concern me, Taboo. Let them solve their own problems. And then... which is going to be very interesting when we're talking about Adrian Veidt. But and then every episode, eventually Taboo would convince him to go help humanity. And then he would, you know, he had the power to access 100% of his brain, which, if you remember, for a long time now they're thinking that this is all bupkis. But for a long time, there was the belief that we only used like 10% of our brain. But he could access all of it, and that gave him the ability to do mind over matter, which is like, Carolyn, what's the name of the guy from Doom Patrol who could change reality with his mind?
Flex Metallo.
Flex Metallo
could flex his muscles to change reality. Mr. Nobody could Mr. theoretically Nobody. Change reality by using his abilities. Yes. Also, this is an advertisement in the middle of Watchmen. Watchmen, Doom Patrol.
Yeah, Doom Patrol. Awesome.
Read Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol run too, please.
Yes.
So Pete Cannon couldn't alter reality, obviously, but he had like super abilities. Like Adrian Veidt does do a lot of those things, like the enhanced fighting, you know, catching the bullet. All of that stuff was his mind over matter. Because he'd done all of this meditation and he could access parts of his brain, and he was an extremely good fighter because he had total control all over his body and he could think 10 moves ahead. And I did try to struggle through it. It was extremely racist, even though it was very pro Asian culture, but in this kind of, you know, obscure, misunderstood, fetishized understanding of what Asian culture is, all mixed together with a bunch of, you know, weird words that don't make any sense. But Carlton has a lot of that going on, but a lot of the different comics going on at that time had those kind of like, well, we're not going to do any actual history about the culture. We're just going to make up some stuff that sounds right.
Yeah, take all the cool stuff.
Because that's what people really want, right? So that was that story is now public domain also. And although they've used it a few times, there is now a mini series from Dynamite written by Kieran Gillen, which I would encourage everybody who listens to the podcast to check out because it's beautiful. And in this podcast, there's kind of like, it's very meta. And at one point, the Peter Cannon in that book goes to an alternate reality where it's a reality in which Alan Moore runs a bar and all of the characters from Watchmen are patrons of the bar. And it's just it's all the Carlton comes. It's almost like he has a big metaphysical discussion with the character that is, I don't think we come out and say that it's Alan Moore, but he looks and acts and talks, and he's definitely supposed to be Alan Moore, about, you know, the nature of his life and what's become of him. And there are a lot of references to quotes and phrases from Watchmen that are used in these conversations when they're talking about Peter Cannon and his bad guy in the weird battle, which I think is himself. I don't remember, but it's a great little nod to Watchmen. So I would advise everyone to go and check that out. That's from Dynamite. It's by Kieran Gillen, and I think it's Pete Cannon Thunderbolts is the title. I think I'll post something up, or I'll give somebody else something to post on the blog.
Probably a nicer treatment than Captain Atom in DC Comics received as far as Watchmen references go. But
I don't know. was there a comic where they specifically called out Alan Moore with Captain Atom?
That I'm not sure of, but I do know like there have been times where like the story of the modern Captain Atom is kind of that lost to humanity kind of thing. I feel like they almost kind of the first run, I know the one with Bates and Wiseman of Young Justice fame, who produced, I don't really remember the first season of Young Justice or second one, but I feel like he definitely pulled a lot of stuff from his Captain Atom run for it. But it's a lot of it is kind of that man out of time, like, and do I still belong and that kind of stuff. But I do feel like later creators really try to Dr. Manhattan him up with like the power level and loss of like the really like loss of humanity kind of stuff. Whereas Nathaniel Atom in his original, well, I'm gonna say original, but I'm talking the DC Comics version of him, he's very human character to me. So I do feel like there's a little disrespect in that sort.
You get a lot of people coming in, I think, who are mixing up the two characters. Like, you don't see a lot of people mixing up Ted Kord and Dan Driver, but you do see a lot more people mixing up Manhattan and Adam in the, you know, more in recent years. All right.
Yeah, it's just, I'm not a fan when they
So now that should, I think that pretty much covers Charlton and the origins of the character. Of course, I mean, again, know that Alan Moore was an avid comics fan, as probably to this day, I would assume, maybe not, but definitely in the silver and the gold and silver and bronze ages. He had a encyclopedic knowledge of comics history. So when he's pulling from characters, he's probably pulling from characters in the genre that fit the archetype. Yes, it was definitely written to be these Carlton characters, and yes, these characters do influence it a lot. But there are other characters that also inspire a little bit, and you know, these kind of above humanity characters that you know are kind of trying to see the bigger picture. We had the first two characters that we talked about being the comedian and Rorschach were kind of, you know, they, yes, yeah, so, trying to put them into perspective. I feel like Laurie and Dan were the kind of human, supposed to be the human viewpoint, but also the kind of impotent viewpoint in that they didn't really
like average Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Kind yes, their biggest victory was to fail to stop Ozymandias, and that's what they had to live with, was that, you know, their part in saving humanity was failing. And then you have, you know, Rorschach and the comedian, who, while being terrible on many levels, recognized at some point that they wanted to stop it, and whether or not that we can debate whether or not that's the right decision. You know, but then you have these characters of you know, Manhattan and Ozymandias, who feel like they can see from a 50-foot view things that other people can't, and are making decisions based on that.
Do you think that there's symbolism? I mean, beyond the characters and beyond Alan Moore's obvious connections to comics, do you think that there is symbolism in Manhattan and Veidt? We're about to talk about the actual character in the actual Watchmen comic, guys, but I'm curious to find out if the group thinks that there is actual symbolism between, you know, what these characters represent, especially Wendy. Wendy, you did live during the 80s when there were all these, you know, world powers. And I think, you know, that's poignant and timely for this time as well, when you have the America, you know, the United States, and you have Russia, and you have all these different countries who think that they're seen, to borrow your metaphor, from, you know, a billion feet away off of a 10-foot tall wall. Do you think that Manhattan and Veidt are metaphors? And if so, what are they metaphors for?
Oh, that's a good question. So where we saw that the comedian was military-industrial complex, I think this is a bit more abstract, maybe even metaphysical concepts. There is that kind of, like we said in the first episode, that Rorschach and the comedian kind of use existentialism as a way to shield themselves from feeling, whereas Manhattan and Veidt truly see the world in this kind of for Veidt it's definitely a numbers game, but for Manhattan it's almost like he's so far above it that even Veidt's numbers game is insignificant. Whether or not the world survives is insignificant to him. And there was this kind of, I can give you the feel for what the world was like back then. I mean, it was without a doubt, you knew there was going to be a total nuclear war. We talked about it every day. We talked about it in school. We had drills in school. We had an alarm that went off once a week as a test, that when you hear it for real, that, you know, that would mean that, you know, the bombs were coming. And when I would hear the test, you would just have that moment where you'd check your watch and make sure it's the right time, because your blood runs cold and you think, oh my gosh, you know, as a kid, every night, you not every night, but quite often you'd have, you know, dreams that you see the flash in the distance and know that it's coming for you. I still have these dreams, you know, today, but for different reasons. But it is just kind of that, like, I mean, if you go back to movies, you know, of that time period, you can go back to War Games and Miracle Mile. And it was just like, this was I don't go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. Alan Moore would have remembered the Cuban Missile Crisis, but that was a point at which you were, really felt like you were moments away from nuclear war. So it was it's easy now to kind of look back on that time and think, you know, Veit was crazy and we never would have had nuclear war, even though they were about to have nuclear war. But yeah, it's because we didn't, and it's still, the possibility is still out there, but people have become so used to, you know, it's never going to happen, that you no longer have that kind of alertness. But it was a real deal. I mean, the Cold War was only barely cold. and there was still a lot of hot, you know, hot spots going on in the world. But yeah, so maybe I get a different view on Veit, and we could talk about that too, because it does feel realer to me than just this kind of idea that maybe if he did nothing, you know, maybe we'd be fine, maybe we wouldn't. And in 1986, it didn't feel like we were going to be fine. I mean, we didn't know that the wall was going to fall in 89. We didn't know. We didn't know that Russia was going to have elections. And you know, now you can even look back on the 90s with a different yeah. viewpoint as well. You know, it just, the war just changed. but it was, you know, I mean, it was real. And it was and this was a big fear. So, I don't know if they're metaphors so much as philosophies. And we could talk about that as well. So maybe they're metaphors for philosophies.
Okay. Vanessa, Josie, you guys want to add anything?
Sorry, I forgot the original question. My bad.
No. Okay, Tony and Vanessa, do you think that Manhattan and Veit aren't just recreations and or homages to the Carlton Comics characters? Do you think that they are also perhaps metaphors? Although, not gonna lie, Wendy, that was probably a really poignant story to share. I did not know that the 80s were that dark. Netflix has lied to me and said that they were all like Stranger Things.
No, they were pretty bad, yeah.
So even in Stranger Things, though, there is that, I mean, especially the season, you know, there is that kind of like, you know, the Russians are invading and, you know, mm-hmm. that was a thing. I mean, if you go watch, I can give a list of movies on the podcast if you guys want to see some of the stuff that we were watching at the time, but it was, you know, that constant idea of that possibly the world could end tomorrow. to some level, every day you don't feel it every day because, you know, you get exhausted.
My mom still has, she still treats the Russians like the boogeyman. She went on a rant on wine a couple years ago. She was just furious about how they were treating certain religious groups in Russia. And she was just like, they've been doing this since before you were born. You just don't understand. Like, she was just very upset. And I was just like, damn those Russians. And like, but I understand where she's coming from. She raised me, you know, me and my brother were born, I was born in 89, at the very end of 89, and my brother was born in 88. And so like, she, you know, she was 20 and having two kids and like terrified of the world around her. I can only imagine like that kind of trauma. Like, she still has deep-seated issues with Russians. I don't know.
I mean, it's not that they're not constantly doing the government.
Yeah, I was saying, it's not topical, but yeah.
It's just a little different.
But to answer your question, I mean, I think that Adrian is supposed to represent man's, this like hubris. He's like, if I can just get my hands around the problem, I can fix it. I can fix it because I know exactly what I'm doing. And Manhattan just kind of, is just the complete avoidance of all of that. He's just is like, what if we just took away all of the emotions and all of the that mushiness that keeps us from actually thinking. Like, there was this like thing he said to Lori. She was having a meltdown on Mars, and he literally goes to her, which is like such a man thing to do. This woman who's literally losing her shit. He goes, "If you only relax enough to see the whole continuum, life pattern or lack of one, then you'd understand my perspective." And I was like, dude, she is having a meltdown. Perhaps this is not the time. I get where he's coming from, but that's like telling someone who's like having an anxiety, just relax. Like, I'm relaxed. I'm calm. Calm down. Like, don't do that. Like, it was just like, he just doesn't, he's so far removed from it that it took him like extra steps to get to even see her perspective, even a little bit of where she was coming from. I don't even know if it got to that point, but I think part of it is, I don't know. I think people equate Ozzy and Doc way too much. I don't think they're on each other's plane at all. I think Manhattan's beyond, I think Veidt was playing a game that Manhattan was never interested in playing. But I think
he convinces him at the end, but we could talk about that.
Oh yeah, I think he convinces him, but I think it wasn't more convincing him. It was more like, yeah, I get it. But also he just didn't care enough to not,
yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know. So yeah, but I feel like Adrian definitely represents like what all of these dudes like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos want to be. Like he's the height of ego. He literally compared himself to Alexander the Great. Like he's obsessed with that kings and pharaohs and like, I can do this. And it's like, so, oh God, he's so annoying. And so it's, but he's like, but we know guys like that. We see him in the news all the time. So it's, I think that's who he really represents. And yeah, Manhattan's supposed to be the godlike figure who's uncaring, who doesn't care about us essentially. And I think a lot of people feel like that about God, if they believe in him or lack thereof or whatever, that they just, he's, you know, mostly uncaring. So anyway.
So I will bring up one thing on the, we should let Tony answer the question first.
Tony, yes.
You're perfect. Okay, I'll go. I guess it's kind of, I think it is, I mean, I know it's Alan Moore, so he's thinking on a higher, it's not just this aspect thing, but I almost think it is kind of like a narrative sort of like a general thing that gets explored in several types of media where, are we doing too much? Is my decision the correct one? Should I be doing this to control all the people kind of thing? At least from Veidt's perspective, it is kind of that question of like, is it right to make that choice for so many people kind of thing? And I'm not going to spoil it, but if you've seen my Twitter, I've been tweeting about Fire Emblem Three Houses for like 2 months since it came out. And that's kind of one of the big core themes of it as well, is was this character correct in starting the war and killing all these people for their ideals? And is the ideal even ethical? That kind of exploration. I do feel like it's something that gets addressed in so many forms of media that's why I know Moore had another level to it, of course. But I do think, if you want to say, is that a metaphor of sorts? I guess I wouldn't phrase it as a metaphor, but I do think it's like a trope almost at this point.
So I wanted to bring up one set of panels that kind of, I feel like there's, I mean, I think there's, it's very easy, and he is definitely loses his shit in, because he's doing all of this stuff that is monstrous, but it's part of the plan. So to me, I'm wondering how much of it is that he had to keep giving himself the ego to continue with the plan, and how is it really that he is this smart, that he, I mean, obviously he's a genius, right? But is it So there is a set of panels where Manhattan is going to visit Veidt, and I feel like this kind of shows us a little bit more of maybe Veidt is deadly serious about this. This isn't necessarily, it is, does take an ego to pull this off. But it's not necessarily the purpose of it. I think it's really easy to say, oh, he's an asshole, thinks he knows what's best for humanity, and it doesn't take people's lives into consideration. But I don't think that's really true, and I'll tell you why. And it's that I don't. And I think this is what Moore wants. He doesn't want to make anything in this book cut and dry, so you can say, you know, this person's right, this person's wrong. But there is this panel that says they're talking about all of these advancements in science, and Veidt is talking to Manhattan, and Laurie is off petting Bobastis, who we could talk about in a bit as well, who is Veidt's genetically modified lynx that is like the closest thing he has to a spouse. But he's doing it for a specific, he's loving this cat for a specific reason, and we'll get to that, and it's monstrous. It will talk about that. This is definitely his the closest thing he has to a partner. But it is, and he's doing it on like calculatedly on purpose, and we'll talk about that in a sec. But he goes to Manhattan, he goes, "And we owe it all to you. With your help, our scientists are limited only by their imaginations." And then Manhattan says to him, "And by their consciences, surely." And I don't know why it's a British accent. And then Veidt looks out the window and says, "Let's hope so." And Manhattan, of course, this is Manhattan thinking about it on the moon. He says, "His eyes are sad and knowing. His servants bring us Indonesian food. And he talks about his business plans all the time, feeding scraps to his beautiful, monstrous cat." But I think, and if you look in the panel, you know, Manhattan's kind of concerned looking at Adrian. And Adrian is this, like, has this really kind of sick to his stomach, worried look on his face. And you feel like this is the moment, like, he quit being a superhero. He came out, and you feel like this is probably the moment where he's like, "I know what I have to do," and being dressing up in a costume and is not it. Right. Although he continues to play that character doing you know, TV specials and whatnot. But I feel like that's it. And I feel like he, and let's talk about Bobastis for just a minute. And he sacrifices Bobastis, but he builds his whole relationship, in my opinion. You can tell me if you think I'm wrong, but I believe that his entire relationship with Bobastis, which he is his constant companion, he talks to like it's his wife. He makes sure that everybody knows this about him, that, you know, the love of his life, his cat, is solely exists for two reasons. And the first reason is that when he's about to disintegrate Dr. Manhattan, Bobastis keeps, he gives Manhattan a false sense of security that he wouldn't kill the cat because he loves the cat. So if the cat is like half of him, he's safe going into the machine with Bobastis. But I think there is a part of me that also believes that he wants Bobastis to die at that moment so that he can feel what other people are feeling. So, because there is some part of him that knows that it's kind of inhuman to be able to do this. And he, you know, like he says, "I meditate on this. I try to feel it." And obviously you can't. But I think that's what that was about, was to put it, give himself the fresh suffering to feel. I find it, otherwise I'd have to believe that he solely did all of that with Bobastis just to put Dr. Manhattan off his guard. And again, I don't, and this is another thing we talk about, I don't think he truly believed he was killing Dr. Manhattan. I thought it would, my guess is he figured it would buy him enough time to convince the others and to be able to make a plea to Manhattan not to kill him. But it worked.
I guess I would think that he's actually smart enough to realize that the way Manhattan thinks, that kind, like, I mean, he might be lured in, but he should be able to tell that, okay, I'm gonna walk in here and get disintegrated.
Maybe, but he did say that he had a very hard time, and this, we find out later that this was, I believe, because of the psychic squid, which we haven't even that he couldn't see what was going to happen, so he really was relying on what, like, he thought intuition. He knew. Yeah, you know, though he won't kill me with Bobastis in here, not realizing that he just killed half of Manhattan. that's the thing is that he was willing to take a sacrifice, and I think he set it up so he would have to take a sacrifice for the team. I'm not saying that, you know, we can't argue more about the ethics about that. I'm saying that I think that complicates the view of him a little bit.
Yeah, because he's not fully like egalitarian or however you want to say it. He might be emotionally compromised as well, kind of.
Or
trying to become.
I don't think so, guys. Adrian is, I think he just did what he did because he really truly saw himself as the savior of mankind. And sometimes I feel like that's all you need. Like, and this is my interpretation, but not every sociopath or every person that does something bad for a good reason needs to have some sort of like humanizing aspect of him. Some people aren't, I don't know if he's meant to be like completely understood. I don't know if he's, I'm not saying he's simple. Like he's like, oh, he's just a bad guy who wants to control the world. I think he's got layers and I think he's fascinating, but I don't know if he's ever had any personal connection since his parents died to the point where he cared enough, like even to Bubastis. I think he had affection for, you know, I think he had affection for certain people, but at the end of the day, his mission was at some point became his goal. His mission was his mission. He wanted to be, he had his mission in mind. He's been doing this. He's been working towards this since destroying half the world or whatever percentage of the world's population, but he was working towards something since his parents died. I think, I just feel like this has always been Adrian. I think there are layers to him, but I don't think that he's that, I don't know if there's a shred of true decency inside of him, like human decency. And I think that's necessary to do what he did. I don't think that you, and I'm not saying that as an insult to him necessarily. I'm just saying as a kind of like, I'm saying it with ambivalence that I don't think that you can do what he did and have any good in you. But I'm not saying he's bad necessarily. I'm just saying that there's some things where like you have to have certain things stripped out of you to be like, yeah, a lot of people have to die for peace to happen. Not a lot of people have that, you know? I don't know. So that's how, I don't know.
He does have guilt though, in that he does want Manhattan to tell him he's not, if a complete sociopath. Wouldn't,
I feel like that was validation, right?
But yes,
I don't know he
wanted, but it was, that's the question is that the sometimes I read it and it's just like, tell me I did a good job, Manhattan. And sometimes I read it as he's extremely doubting that he did, like, it's done now. Yeah. And he's like, I have to live with it. And I feel like he feels that's sacrifice. I don't know. He feels like, I think he probably should have stood in the middle of Manhattan, but he believed that he was going to lead the world into this new utopia, which he goes on to later, which might be what this show is about.
That's what I'm, I'm genuinely curious if you're right or if I'm right. if he's got regrets, if he has guilt, or if he's just like, this is exactly the world that I wanted. Like, I really, really am curious if, you know, when the show premieres and like what his thought process of the world around him, a world without internet and cell phones or whatever, like, which feels a little bit worse. I mean, I don't know. Is there a world worse than ours currently? I don't know. But I find it fascinating. Like, I'm curious though. But I understand where you're, I do get where you're coming from.
Yeah, he is trying to help the world. He's done the calculations. He knows the statistics. And that's the interesting thing too, is I think part of his, so Manhattan is so far above it that he's like, oh, okay, so my being here was causing the problem. And now that I don't have to be here, you know, for Lori's sake or whatever reason he came back to Earth, we can talk about in a minute. Mm-hmm. That if he doesn't have to be here, he can go off and into space and do something else. I think Veidt did think that he was in a kind of weird twisted way, and I think he really wanted that confirmation that like he was feeling some remorse, some guilt, but he felt his sacrifice was to take that on. And you do see that a lot from if you go back to Jack Nicholson and the movie with Tom Cruise, was that A Few Good Men? You want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. Is this too old for everybody?
Might be a little bit for me, but
I'm bad on that.
I'm bad where I only watch cartoons and stuff.
So so this was this movie, and it is a Tom Cruise movie, but he was a lawyer, and there was a general, and the general had made these decisions, and they were trying to get, he broke him on the stand. And the speech the general makes is that he has to go out there to make the hard decisions, decisions mm-hmm. that you're afraid to make. And, you know, obviously in that one, that general has done something terrible. And of course he's on trial for it. And this is his admission of guilt that he had done it. But, you know, his justification of course is that he needs to take that guilt for other people. And I don't think it's a noble thing in that case, but that's kind of the other part of it, is this kind of belief that, you know, dirty. And I'm not sitting, and I'm going to sit here saying, as someone who is my age, who's been through a lot of stuff in life, and I'm not saying that I've made black choices, you know, for the greater good. But I'd say that there are many times when I've been in situations where neither choice was good and a choice has to be made. So that is the thing what I'm saying here is, like, let's take Adrian out of the situation and think about it as ourselves. And if you knew without a doubt that if you did nothing, that the world was going to end, or you could kill half of Manhattan and the world would not end. And you knew that. And let's just take all of the, you know, he's not as smart as he thinks he is. Let's just assume he is as smart as he thinks he is. And that is the all powerful. That is it, that you are making a choice between 80% of the world's population or half of Manhattan. Would you be able to make the choice?
Without the fly in the ointment, because his plan didn't exactly go off without a hitch. But I don't know. Yes. I don't know if I can answer that question. I really don't know. That's the thing. Like, I feel like you have to be in a certain mind to really truly say, like, yeah. But, like, I don't know. I don't know if I can definitively say, because I can prevent the world from ending, but I have to kill a certain percentage of people. A lot of people will be like, yeah, the world doesn't end, though. Sure, but then you have to live with the fucking guilt of being responsible for a lot of people dying. I don't know if I can hold that. I don't know if you know what I mean? So that's something I don't know if I can answer.
That does seem like an unanswerable question, though, because for most people, no people ever consider, like, the deeper ramifications. Answering a question like that is always shaped by a person's experiences. A person who says, you know, fuck mankind, everybody's been mean to me, everything's expensive, people are garbage. A person who says that is going to have a completely different answer from a person whose experiences are nice.
That's so, not Veidt, though. That's Rorschach.
And Rorschach chose to not. But here's my thing. I think Rorschach and Adrian are, I don't know, kind of the same side, the same coin. I mean, the two sides of the same coin. They both see the world pretty, pretty stark. One said, I have to do this to save the world. And the other said, no, absolutely not. That's not how we save the world. And that's the kind of the question you're asking is that, I mean, I don't know.
I think the difference between Veidt and Rorschach is that, and I'm not saying, you know, Veidt is obviously not an angel, but I think that Veidt doesn't judge anybody morally at all. You know, it's really how they fit into his plan. It's just purely math, but I think he does care about people and worries about people, but he is able to take the humanity out of it. In Manhattan, at some point, is just like, screw them all. He just walks away.
Can you take the humanity out of caring about people?
I know. Well,
can you?
He does. He does.
Cold. He cares. I don't know if he cares.
It's cold, yeah. Maybe it's just math. Maybe it is just math. Maybe he knows the winning of the game. Maybe he does look at it like
a man on a cinder.
Yeah, it's like a video game, right?
Yeah.
I've got to win the video game, and if I had to sacrifice, half of my population on Sims to get to enlightenment, then we'll do that.
Yeah, and only one person can flee the planet when it's over.
Yeah, I guess to answer the question myself, I could just say I wouldn't do it, because it's kind of like that. I don't know if you've seen like the ethical question thing where, like, okay, there are four people on one side and one person on the other side. Do you pull the lever?
Oh, the good
kill
place.
One person. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the
trolley problem. Yeah.
And I would just say no, because I guess maybe I'm too Manhattan-y or something, but it does feel like. If fate is gonna doom us all, I prefer that than to be responsible for the choice.
Having grown up
that causes
with
harm.
Star Trek: The Next Generation, where I don't know if you guys are familiar, but every episode they stick with the moral high ground, and every episode they succeed. As a matter of fact, there's like a running joke, because there's the Klingon or the one guy, the security guy, is always like, no, we can't do that. We're all going to die. It's going to happen. Or I wouldn't advise this, because it's so. And every time they tell him, basically, like, yeah, whatever, they dismiss him and do what they were going to do anyways. And every time they turn out okay. But that's not how it is in real life. And there are many times in real life when you literally are forced with a time specific question with a time specific problem with no good answer. No good answer. And like, if you've ever been a healthcare proxy for end of life, I mean, you will live with guilt no matter what choice you make. It's what guilt? You have to make the choice. A choice has to be made. There's no way to not make the choice. Not making the choice is a choice, but you have to make the choice. And there are other situations too, where it's like, you have to decide which is right and which is wrong. And it depends on how much empathy there is. There are times when you compromise, and there are times when you realize that there is no right answer. I'm not saying that this is right. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that I can't make that decision, because I'm not that – I'm smart. I'm very smart. I'm not that smart. I don't have that. But I think, there is – you have to almost understand that when we're not – when we don't make that decision, that in itself is a decision. And I think the idea of like, well, I just wouldn't make the decision, or like, it is a decision. If all seven people die, you're still going to feel guilty for that, even if you didn't pull the trigger. It doesn't take the guilt away. It's just, it's like everybody plays the lottery, and everybody dreams about playing the lottery. But if you had that money, I feel like even if I had that kind of huge, like Mega Millions jackpot, like a small jackpot where I could pay off all my bills and buy a house, that would be great. But the big Mega Millions jackpot,
yeah,
where you could actually make a difference in the world, I think I would go insane. I'm pretty sure I would go insane. Like that kind of power to make the change, then you're suddenly stuck with the responsibility of making the change. And I feel like that's what Vite is kind of in that situation, is that it's real easy to knock it up and say, egotistical maniac. But he is that smart, and he does kind of have that responsibility of making that huge, powerful decision, because he could do it. And it's like, he's not entirely sure he could do it, but he's pretty sure he knows how to save the planet. And it is just like, I don't ever want to be in that situation. And I can say that very frankly, I don't ever want to be in that situation, but it's hard to say that what you would do. You have to make it. The time the clock is ticking. You have to make the decision. You're going to make a decision. If he didn't, and if Dr. Manhattan, did the wrong thing or left or had a fight with Laurie or whatever. And yes, we can also talk about, and this is the other thing that we need to talk about as well, is he did cause that fight with Laurie.
But
he caused it all. But to kind of see what was happening, like, if Dr. Manhattan ever left or died or had a bad day, the world would end. And I think he couldn't. I think that's, you have to take it down as that's kind of what he was.
Too dangerous, almost.
Yeah. It was, he had to be taken off the table, or
But just to talk about Manhattan for a second, who put that problem in his lap in the first place? It was humans, bro. It wasn't Manhattan's problem. Like, he was just I'm sorry. He came out here. He's just trying to do his job. The homeboy got zapped. He got reassembled. He got came back. And now all of a sudden, everyone's trying to make a symbol out of him. And everyone's at this peak. And everyone's like, ugh. And he suddenly becomes the linchpin in a nuclear war. He had nothing to do with. Now, I'm not saying he's completely innocent. Of course, he stepped in. He could have been like, nah, I'm not going to do that. But he, you know, he was just like, whatever. But like, I fully refuse to put this all on Manhattan, like suddenly like having a fight with his girlfriend and leaving, like all of a sudden the world ends. No, this is fully a human problem. This is 100% a human problem.
Manhattan
exacerbated it, but it's a human problem.
Can I offer a point of view on this I think, not to interrupt, because I, first of all, number one, I agree with Vanessa.
That it's not Manhattan's fault. That doesn't mean that he isn't the fault.
But all the boy
wanted was to fix watches and drink cold beer.
And hang out with his girlfriend, who eventually got to the money dumpster. But no, I think what, and this is, I'm about to say some things here. Friends, and if you have issues with people being upset with Zack Snyder, feel free to, because I'm about to get into everybody's favorite number one film, Batman versus Superman, and I'm about to get into Watchmen, because one of the things, I saw Watchmen first, and Watchmen, his version of Watchmen to me was as close of an adaptation, I think, as you could have gotten. Like, and I know that there are people who will say, no, that's not accurate. And yes, we all miss the giant squid. We all miss the squid.
Squiddy.
And
this
little the squid. Where was the squid? This was my big, like, 13, 14-year-old objection. I was like, where's the squid? You bastard, eat my squid. But the theme of Watchmen is the idea of what human beings will do when confronted with absolute power. And this is a theme that Moore plays with a lot, because in Swamp Thing, he played essentially Alec Holland. Yes, we're, you know, pour one out for Swamp Thing Radio. Alec Holland is as close to all powerful as he can get. He is literally the Earth. If he decided that he wanted to kill everyone on the planet, and if you guys will remember, that was a thing. If he decided he wanted to kill every human being on the planet, he could. He could without an issue. Okay? And he could do it without an issue. And Dr. Manhattan, to me, was the same thing in Watchmen comics. And Snyder talked about it in the movies, and the problem with his adaptation for Superman, for me, was that he tried to do the same thing with Superman, and he can't do that with Superman. Even I know that, and I barely read any Superman comics, but that's beside the point. For a long time, I was convinced that somehow he had failed in the Watchmen adaptation, and that was why he tried to bring it to Batman versus Superman, because he was trying to articulate the idea that human beings, when faced with absolute power, will make stupid decisions. And that is a core theme of Moore's work, is that he will bring primarily cis heterosexual white males to absolute power, and the moment that they achieve absolute power, it is the moment that they become inhuman. And that's an important distinction to note. And people don't process inhumanity well. People fight against it. People try and worship it. People don't process inhumanity well because they don't process absolute power well. We are not a species that is made to understand absolute power. I agree with Vanessa, because it is a human problem, but it is a human problem that I don't think human beings can conquer, and it's not a malicious human problem. It's a human problem that is based on the idea that when we are confronted with absolute power, we completely freeze up and we don't know what to do. Because, and it's for a microcosm, for people who may not understand that, you know, in terms of philosophy, okay, the idea of free will and absolute, the idea of free will and choice is, in a sense, absolute power. I could choose right now, I'm not going to because it would be a bad idea, I could choose right now to hang up on this podcast and throw my phone in the garbage and never talk to anybody again.
I could choose that. I think that's the question. Yeah. Could you actually do statistically? So So this is what Adrian's saying, is Adrian's looking at the statistics and saying the probability that that's going to happen is really low. So it's the same thing with quantum physics, that if the probability is really low, it's almost like it can't happen.
So we're talking about two different ideals. No, but you guys are both right. You're talking numbers and we're talking humans. Humans, math is finite. Math is answers. Math is literally facts. Humans are completely unpredictable messes. And as someone, I'm going to bring in a little bit, I think over the course of these episodes, I'm going to bring in a little bit of a religious aspect, because I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness. So I'm not like a Jehovah's Witness anymore. I'm just super, still like within my religious roots, I pray every night, whatever. I don't talk about it. It's my private thing. But I want to say that what Carolyn said is absolutely, like, if you look at, if you don't have to believe in, this is not like me, I'm not going to preach or anything, but if you look at the, like, the Bible, whether you view it as fiction or nonfiction, what did they do when they saw absolute power, when they saw an actual God walking the earth? They fucking killed him. So here's what humans are and cannot. They are correct. They literally, humans cannot deal with that kind of, we cannot conceptualize it to the point where we can, we just see, we go in, there's no, historically and fictionally and non-fictionally, we cannot deal with that kind of power. So I think that is exactly correct. Like, I think we don't function well with it. So Superman, as a Superman stan, I love him. And I love Dr. Manhattan, but I love him for two different reasons. They represent absolute power in different forms.
Yeah, like the two extremes almost.
Yeah. When one, you have someone who cares so much about human beings, because he's the opposite. Who said it earlier? It was basically the opposite of
It's written by two Jewish boys, right?
Right. It's completely, they're so fascinating because they're two ends of the spectrum, but like, this is how you tell a story. Like, those are the two ways. I mean, there's obviously multiple ways. You can go the evil route, like dark side, but like, there's a fascinating way, but that's another question. Is the opposite of good evil, or is it indifference? In Manhattan's case, is he the opposite of good?
Is he really indifferent too?
That's another, very true.
He likes to think he's indifferent, he can see it. So let's talk about that. So there's this amazing scene, and if you haven't read Watchmen while you're listening to this podcast, stop and go read the book. But
right,
then you can come back later and we'll have fun. But there is a passage in Watchmen that's recreated time and time again. In fact, when the showrunner, what's his name?
Damon Lindelof.
Originally, I'm sorry, I'm not going to edit you and edit this out. I'm going to just own it. When he originally announced that he was doing the show, he wrote it in that Dr. Manhattan, in this Dr. Manhattan speak. And Dr. Manhattan speak is this one issue of the comic. It is issue 4. And if you read one issue of Watchmen, this is the issue to read. Dr. Manhattan goes to, he's had a bad day, and he goes to Mars, and he's starting to think about his life. And you start to understand in this issue that Dr. Manhattan doesn't live in time the same way we live in time. Mm-hmm. To him, everything is happening at the same time. So as he moves, when he does his recollections, he's a little bit moving through chronologically, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to follow. He's also moving through thematically. So as, you know, as something happens, he then goes back to the origin point of that and then flashes forward and back. So it's roughly chronological, but there's a lot of back and forth based on themes, and then, you know, ripples of previous themes coming forward in time and backwards in time. And it's just very, it had never been done before, and it gave you a view of life that was very, it was dispassionate, but also like he could see himself feeling from far away. I was describing to someone that this was how I feel when I take an Ativan. I'm so really stressed out, but I'm watching it from about 50 feet away.
Hello.
When I am in stressful situations, and I started doing this a few, you know, years ago, and it is kind of like a meditation technique, is that if you just imagine that it's 20 years in the future and you're looking back on this moment, you know, you feel a little bit more relaxed because it's in the past.
So, right.
So you have to take yourself out of that moment. But I mean, it's just kind of that thing to the point where he can take himself so out of the moment because he can see everybody's death. You know, he can see, you know, the past, the present, and the future all as one thing. Although he doesn't, he does in Doomsday Clock, but he doesn't really in Watchmen talk about the future. In Doomsday Clock, he's like looking forwards and backwards and seeing because, you know, DC has a very rich sense of time, so he's seeing the future of the DC universe, the back of it, and everything is interconnected. And we don't need to talk about the horrible things they did to the Legion. but this backwards and forwards in time. But you know, that's it. And he's starting to think, does my doing, and remember, this was a guy who had no control over what happened to him. What happened to him was an accident. He didn't choose to become Dr. Manhattan. And now he's looking at life, asking this question. We can say, is this because of his power, or is this because of how he got his power? That does he actually, even him at his level, is he going to have any effect on the universe? Is there free will? Am I, you know, he pulls a beautiful clock sculpture out of the sand on Mars, and he's asking, am I making this, or was it already in the sand and I'm just revealing it? And that's the other question. And really, you know, Veidt's definitely made a plan that everyone else is kind of like just, and he's, maybe this is him intuiting that as well. Everyone else is just kind of falling into what Veidt has predicted they would do. But again, in maybe he does know that as well. And it's the question is anything, if I can see the future and the past at the same time, am I actually in control? Yeah.
And he says that to her. He says to Lori, like, I'm just a puppet who can see the strings. Like, and I got a great screenshot of him, like the little panel, and it was just his dick was in it. So I just was like, nah, I'm going to delete it. if you want to do with that. Literally, like, is he in control of anything? And I'm just going to keep pointing this out because then we got to talk about it, y'all. He didn't predict everybody's because Rorschach did the thing. He submitted his notebook. Like, I'm going to keep talking about it. Veidt is not smart as he thought he was because he couldn't predict human behavior. He could do the math. He could do it all, but he could not predict Rorschach.
Right. That's what this is going to reveal. What I hope is, what did the journal do? And and maybe Veidt calculated, maybe his probability was that it's too crazy, no one will believe it. Maybe he thought that Rorschach wouldn't have had time to write down everything, because remember, they do go pretty quickly to figuring out what happened to getting to the North Pole.
But you're right. And here's the thing. Think about our world now. We have the New Frontiersmen, and that's basically Daily Caller or whatever that guy is, Alex Jones is saying. We have people who, they just straight up make up lies, and people run with it. This is someone who, if that's what they're going to explore, if they took it and they're like, they publish it and everyone's like, that's garbage. But there's a small sect, and I think we mentioned this in a previous podcast, of a small sect of paranoid conspiracy theorists who are like, no, we believe this, and they keep growing. And it becomes, threaten the peace that he sacrificed so many people for? And I really, 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 really hope that's something that they talk about. Was the notebook, I mean, his journal anything? What it did blow everything up? Because that's my whole theory. My whole issue with Adrian, it really hinges on Rorschach's journal at this point. Because I'm like, he couldn't be that damn smart, because Rorschach couldn't predict Rorschach. So I'm like, that's really where my like thing is, because I completely agree. Like, he really did. He's brilliant in the fact that he essentially took all the players out. He was building these building blocks for so long before anyone even saw the patterns. And he constructed in a way that made sense, but he still couldn't predict it to the point where if Rorschach was a blind spot, but like, I don't know how he couldn't see that. And maybe he did. I guess Rorschach did say, and like he said, that they got the rough draft, but they never got his final copy or something. So he had another backup copy. So maybe he didn't predict that part, but I just really want that. I'm like really curious about that piece of it. And if he, you know, what he thinks of it or whatever.
And I think it was kind of left open, you know, what was going to happen with it, or what was the point with it, or is it still something that, I mean, Adrian did string him along a lot. You would think there would have been much easier ways. And is this it too? Is that maybe he wants to be held accountable. But there were so many ways he could have got rid of Rorschach, right?
Yeah.
And he didn't do the easy one, which was just kill him, you know, or just have him, something bad happened to him in prison or whatever. You know?
Right. I was going to say, why did you, I mean, maybe he just assumed he would die in prison, but it's weird that he didn't just go for the jugular, right? Like, he straight up murdered the comedian.
He knew.
Maybe he just didn't care.
Yeah.
He knew that they were going to come, that both of them were going to come to Antarctica. I think that was always in the plan, and I think a lot of this was angling it so that they figured it out and came, and he, you know, that he didn't have to just tell them everything that happened. He wanted to be judged, he wanted to be beat up, he wanted to see if he could win, and all that stuff is there. Is this a kind of like self, he wanted to hurt himself. So I think everything, I don't think any of that happened. The journal, I don't know. And I don't know if we're supposed to know. And I think that we'll explore. That definitely is something that gets explored in the show, I hope. I mean, if so, if Jeremy Irons is probably who you think
probably he is. Probably. That jawline, they can't tell me he's not.
I can't imagine that they're going to start that with some kind of spoiler. No, it's
no. They're definitely teasing us. But like, I'm like just very excited. I'm so excited. I just really want to see the extension of the story specifically. And if we have Manhattan in the show as well, I want to see what the hell has he been doing the last 7 years? Has he been making people, like?
Just before we get too far off it, if you guys don't know what we're talking about, the New York Comic-Con solicits listed Jeremy Irons as the, you know, playing the character, probably who you think he is. We can post that on the blog.
Yeah, being very coy.
It was very cute. I saw all the Twitter replies. Everyone was kind of, how dare you? That kind of stuff.
There's a few more philosophical questions, and we could talk about Laurie as well, and the conversation on the moon. On Mars, and I think also the perfumes. Can we talk a little bit about the perfumes? They're used all
unforgettable.
Kind of, well, there's nostalgia.
Yeah, right? The one that's like spit tumbling or whatever.
Yeah, and then later it becomes millennium. This kind of, and that is kind of themes of the book, and people use it like, oh, you know, what do you, it smells like nostalgia, right? You see the change from the earlier parts of the book being nostalgia to, once the nuclear war has been averted, moving on to millennium, and you get this feeling that, like, of course, remember this was 15 years before the millennium. It was still the shiny future where we had flying cars. That now that we have this, the past has now been severed. Manhattan is gone. You know, all of the heroes are going on to different lives. And then the future is somehow up for, I guess, Vite and humanity. I mean, it's not like humans get to be themselves again, but they're still all puppets of Adrian Veidt until he gets exposed. And even then, I got to assume that we'll find out he had some plan all along.
Assuming it's not a retelling set in the current.
Present.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we could talk about, I think we talked about this a little bit before, but there are, we are at a point right now where we are, again, seeing the imminent destruction of the planets. And it's terrible to say that. It's a totally different kind of destruction, but it's imminent. And we are seeing, I mean, there's a real fear about, you know, the world not making sense, which was obviously something that was present in the 80s. But you know, we're at a time right now, world doesn't make any sense. The truth isn't truth. The planet is dying. There's complete unpredictability in global politics, and even more unpredictability in global economics than there was in the 80s, in my opinion. It's another era of uncertainty, and thus I feel like that's the pitch of why we need a Watchmen show.
Absolutely. I think that there are so many shows now are being divided up into what's okay for the right to watch and what's okay for the left to watch, because people can't handle or not handle, people just don't want to see, I don't know if they're interested in nuance or not, or most people just want to watch something that's is apolitical and doesn't want anything to do with anything, which is totally fine. And I find it interesting when people are upset that Watchmen is going to touch politics, or if it's not going to touch politics enough. And it's, at the end of the day, it's everything is essentially political. So what I found interesting about that, there was something that he had said about not wanting to say what is right and what is what, tell the audience what is right and what is wrong, because no one has, which is what Alan Moore, you know, he left it up to us, left up to the audience, the reader, to figure out, you know, who was right and who was wrong. And I'm curious, because every single character in the trailer we've seen, none of those people look like people we would essentially just immediately root for. They all look like kind of messes, which is literally what the characters from the original series was. Like, they were all messes. I don't even know if I can completely root for anyone. Were you guys rooting for anyone at any point? Like, I was just kind of like, tumbling from one panel to the next. Like, I don't know what's going on, but I'm so compelled, because that's life, right? Like, most of the time, I'm just trying to see what the hell's going on. And I find that, hope that if he keeps up with the spirit of that, like, it's all inherently political. Putting a Black woman in the lead of, in a mask, a vigilante with dudes in her truck is still political. That's, mm-hmm. it's inherently political.
And she's police.
Yeah. Like, she's mm-hmm. a police officer. Like, it's an all inherently political. You have mask killing cops when we have a society where cops aren't trusted right now. Like, it's all political. Like, it's just because it's not, and the way the media frames us, you know, right or left, it doesn't mean it's not, you know, going to be relevant. Mm-hmm. I think we are so used to things being shoved into one pocket or the other that we're uncomfortable with anything asking the question of, you know, maybe this isn't, we're not asking if it's right or wrong. Maybe we're just asking you to think about it, you know, and I don't think this people are comfortable with that.
So my kids had curriculum night this week, and so I got to learn how they're teaching them things, and they have switched the way they're teaching kids to more of kind of like, I think it's called inquiry based education, where instead of telling them what to think, they're asking them what mm-hmm. they think. And I think this is trying to respond to what has happened to society today, where A, we believe there's a right answer and a wrong answer, and B, that people take things as reality without questioning them. And you see, it is a very interesting thing. Like, the kids are very engaged, because instead of saying, here, you know, let's go through the lesson, here's this and this and this, they said, here's a situation, let's go around the room and see what everybody thinks. You know, what do you think you should do in this situation, or what do you think the answer is to this? I mean, eventually, you know, I work a lot in user testing, and you find that I'm going to get totally off topic and forget how I got here, but there was a test that they did to prove that crowdsourcing worked, right? And what they did was they put a cow up, and they said, guess the weight of the cow and you win a prize. And what they proved was that you could then take that statistical information of the guesses, like, these were like way off the wall random guesses, and take like the average of that, you know, to get rid of the outliers, and the median would be within a few bits, within a few pounds, the actual weight of the cow. no, I mean, obviously, when you're going to like a 4-H fair, you have people who know what cows weigh, right?
Yeah.
but it is kind of that thing is that, like, you know, inherently, if you're asking questions of morality or, you know, civics responsibility, you want to raise a generation that doesn't just take that, you know, that knows inherently what the right answer is and not just doing what they've been told to do.
Right. So, which is why we have a generation. Yeah. We have a generation of boys and girls and people who don't understand, who truly still don't understand what consent is. That's a problem. Like, there's a huge knowledge gap of certain things that should just automatically be known. And I think it's because we're not really educating people or really talking. We're literally just telling them we're avoiding the topic or just slapping like a, hey, don't do that. And then moving on to the next thing. Like that was my sex education in high school was like, yeah, basically the mean girls is like, if you have sex, you will get AIDS and you will die. And that was it. And I was like, okay, cool. And
mine
so,
was
like
that. So sorry. But
no, go ahead.
Mine was like that, but they, I hope I'm not getting anyone in trouble, but they taught us about like birth control and stuff in the anatomy class.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anatomy, of course, is not required.
Right.
Versus health, that is. So right. Not everyone's getting that level of, okay, well, right. This is how the chemicals work. And this is how, if you have these parts, you take this and to avoid pregnancy. If you have these, you take these to avoid impregnating anyone, that kind of thing. So they taught us, but. It was
out of
very scientific. It was
mine was fear based. Exactly. anyway, way off topic. Sorry,
we got a bit off topic. But yes, I think we were. I feel like at some point we were talking about the fears of modern society and how we live in an uncertain society and how we are polarized much more. I mean. You know, the average New Yorkers that you were looking at, or the average citizens that you were looking at in Watchmen, were all very much like kind of pawns in the game. I mean, they were reacting to things.
Yeah.
All right. So I'll bring up something that I don't think we've really talked about. Did we talk about this maybe in the first episode? I don't know, but the imagery and of the triangles,
mm-hmm.
And you know what that meant. So. I posted a while ago a series of images that happened in kind of rapid succession that were, and I think it was to show how much Adrian, and maybe it wasn't, to show how much Adrian was manipulating the situation where there was the cult and the guy that committed suicide and there was a poster on the wall. And that was the same poster that it was very similar in design to the poster that it was the benefit that the lesbian cab driver's band mm-hmm. was going to perform at. That was more for like against women, violence against women. And it was a very different kind of thing. But the poster was almost the same poster. And then you cut to the artist drawing a picture of the squid. And it's again a triangle with the shapes are all in the same place. And you just, what is going on with that? Does anybody want to go?
I don't know. That's one of those things where I love when people point this stuff out, but I'm not good at getting a meaning out of it.
Okay. I don't know if I'm crazy or not. I don't know if Carolyn has a point of view on this at all, but like when I was looking at that, because we had talked about that in the first episode briefly. And so when I was looking at the Watchmen Motion comic, I was like paying attention specifically for that. And I also noticed that, like, you know, with the like little symbol on Doc Manhattan's head. And also, like, there's imagery coming up in the show where Lori's, like being tied up and there's, like, the Doc Manhattan symbols behind her. And I was looking at these and I was like, that kind of looks like, you know, Alpha Omega symbols. And I was like, oh, shit. And I started thinking about that.
Wait, what do I have an opinion on?
Wait, I was saying.
like visual symbolism.
Yeah, the symbolism of like the triangle and the, and I was thinking just like with the symbol on Manhattan said, it's like the triangle looks like an A, like the alpha symbol and omega, like the beginning and the end. And I don't know if that, I just was like starting to think about that and my brain started to break a little bit because technically Doc Manhattan, if he would be the beginning and the end. Anyway, so that's kind of what I was thinking just from like the start of it. But yeah, and if anyone else has something else to say.
write in and tell us about it, because going back to what we were saying earlier about Manhattan, which is what I was technically touching on when I was talking about the idea that Manhattan and Vite are both symbols, going back to what we were saying about Manhattan, the thing about Dr. Manhattan is that it again is trying to digest that whole all-powerful confrontation with all-powerful sorts of entities. And so I would personally agree with that assessment. Also, you have to remember and I'm going to look it up really quick, because I think hydrogen. It's the symbol for hydrogen. And
yep,
the
hydrogen
symbol,
bomb.
If you look at the uses for hydrogen, commercial fixation of nitrogen from the air, hydrogen nation of fats and oils, methanol production, rocket fuel, welding, production of hydrochloric acid, reduction of metallic cores. So since it's the symbol of hydrogen, which essentially is used for expansion and thought, then Manhattan represents a sense of not just us trying to come to terms with that, but also us trying to come to terms with our own potential. If we dig into the philosophical side of this, and if we, you know, and again, I might get a little religious too here. Sorry, everybody. Yes, I am an LGBT person who is Christian and does believe in that. God teaches that, you know, I've always kind of interpreted God as teaching that mankind, when they follow him, have limitless potential. And that, you know, there is love that is limitless, and then there's stuff that is limitless that comes of that. Human beings have endless, endless amounts of potential, however you choose to see it, for religion, philosophy, math, science, art, anything else. The idea behind Manhattan that is echoed through all of the tropes and all of the comic books and all of the everything else is the idea that we can reach beyond our mortal forms, and that we can cease to be isolated. And it happens in science too. I'm not going to go off on a long tangent about this, but everybody remember the Mars rover?
Mm-hmm.
Remember how
it's so sang bad.
Yeah, it sang happy birthday to itself. Logically, there is absolutely no reason that we should have trained a machine to sing happy birthday to itself and to sing its own goodbye songs. There is no reason whatsoever that we should. But it is because we are fundamentally trying to understand a larger purpose and the fact that we are part of something bigger and have this limitless potential. When Moore created Manhattan, at least to me, and he used the hydrogen symbol, it was an unintentional metaphor for the lengths that humans would go. And even in the comics and in the movie, they talk about how it was the end of the age of the hero and the dawning of the age of the superhero. If people met characters like Poison Ivy or Spider-Man or Venom, or, and I'm looking at all my Funkos on the wall, or Wonder Woman, or all of these different characters, if people ever actually met these beings, it wouldn't be the sort of thing that would be idolized. It would be a cult around them. People would either idolize them or worship them or try to kill them. Because there's a quote that I love listening to, and I forget who said it. Whenever I'm down, there is a quote, and it really fits everything with Manhattan, and it really fits, in some way, it really fits Vite too. In fact, it fits all of Watchmen's characters, because what makes us messy is the idea that our fear is not that we are inadequate. Our fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. And we operate on that assumption as human beings. Everyone's fear is that we are powerful beyond measure, that if we truly wanted to, the free will, the science, the art, all of the things that we have created, we could truly make an impact on everything that we do.
You see this in the resistance to environmental science today, though. There is part of us that is this idea that we want to believe that the world is, that we cannot affect the world, right? That we are not capable of destroying the world. You hear that from, you know, climate change deniers all the time. Or this is just the world doing what it normally does, which is total bullshit. But this kind of idea that we're too small for that. When the fact of the matter is that we could blow the world to kingdom come. You know, and it's all of that is within our power. And this is something too, is that, like, it's a growing up of society in a sense, because, you know, when you're younger, you have this, you don't necessarily believe that you're immortal, but your world is your world and you live in this happy world. And then something happens that destroys that world at some point in your life. And then your understanding of everything. And on the one hand, you've had your own mini apocalypse and some people get destroyed by it. But at the same time, if you survive that, you now have a view of the world that is much closer to reality and how fragile we actually are and how easy it is for us to destroy everything. And the power is it's both, you're both powerful and completely helpless at the same time. Now, I do believe that, yes, you know, mankind has a limitless power, but each person doesn't necessarily have a limitless power. But that's maybe a conversation for another day.
I mean, but again, and that's truthfully though, Wendy, if we're gonna get honest, the fact that your worldview, I mean, like, if we're really gonna get honest, and I'm gonna go slightly manic and break this down fully to the point, technically the fact that your worldview is a certain way is in fact you believing that you have limitless potential to influence my worldview.
I don't know. See, I and this is the other thing is that I find it very difficult to convince people to change who they are or to change the way they see the world through discussion. I find that when some people, if you live a life that goes exactly how you expect it, you are unlikely to be as maybe empathic or open to someone who has been through a horrible tragedy or some life destroying event, right? You've just been forced to see beyond the veil. But yeah, no, I'm not saying that you know, we're not doing, we're, you know, we don't need, you know, an evil villain. We're doing it to ourselves. But at the same time, like, to be able to actually see, it's like, all right, so there was a movie a long time ago called Grand Canyon, and, you know, probably the early 90s. And it was a movie about a bunch of people that lived in Los Angeles. And they were all caught up in their egos, right? And in this little world of Los Angeles. And I, you know, I think that Vanessa and Carolyn probably know what, you know what that kind of mentality is like, that kind of I am the star. Because when you're in Los Angeles and you look up at the sky, I don't know if it's still true today, but you could not at that time see the stars, like, at all. Like, to the point where when the Northridge earthquake happened, people looked up into the sky and started calling 911 because there was some smoke cloud in the sky, not realizing that that was the Milky Way. And this is true. And that is how bad it was. The light pollution was so bad you couldn't see the stars. So all of your universe was in, but if, you know, not far away, you know, less than a day's drive was the Grand Canyon. And when you go to the Grand Canyon or when you drive through Utah and you realize how absolutely infinitesimally tiny you are, that also is freeing in a way that allows you to see the universe for what it is. You know, it's an interesting thing as you get caught up, and Veidt also got caught up in the fact that he could do this thing, that maybe he didn't look like Manhattan as to whether he should do it.
True.
I think that we're only as important as the impact we make on other people. I think that when Doc Manhattan is literally like, what is your squabbles, your baggage? I mean, what does that mean to, you know, the stars? What does that mean to the universe? That means nothing. It's infinitesimal, means nothing. But I mean, you can say that, but like, who cares?
That's why it was
ludicrous, because it's at the end of the day, it's, we define, like, I get it, but we define our reality and we define our importance in the universe around us. We have limitless potential to do everything. What we're choosing to do with it is kill each other. So that's what we're doing. And I think I get what both of you are saying. I think it's disingenuous to say that humans aren't important in the grand scheme of things, because if we weren't, I don't know if I buy into that necessarily, but I do think that there's something that we said, that we do overblow certain things because we make ourselves more important than we are in the grand scheme of things. But I do think we're pretty important. I don't know. Maybe I'm just the middleman. I don't know. But I do think that I disagree in the sense that I don't think we're unimportant, because
that's
we could
comes.
Yeah. And yeah,
the miracle of Lori. And the miracle, I mean, yes, in the grand scheme of things, but the fact that life exists on Earth we still haven't come close to finding a planet that is capable of holding life. So there mm-hmm. is something, regardless of whatever you surround it with, the fact, and this is where he comes to, right, is that mm-hmm. the fact that Lori could exist
is yeah.
with the situations of her birth, and the fact that humanity even exists at all is...
In the grand scheme of things, exactly. Yeah,
it maybe it's a statistical miracle. I don't know. Maybe we just were very, very lucky to be born. But again, to just for life to exist, for intelligent life to exist, for these two people to get together. And that's where he finally is able to talk himself mm-hmm. into going back to Earth. And that is also the reason why he decides to leave.
To go make some more, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and to say, well, you know, I need Lori's now happy if she's found something that I'm going to leave her with this, but also I don't want to be the one who ends life on Earth. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to leave because, you know, I'm not going to tell everybody what happened. And maybe he doesn't want to see what happens when the journal gets released. I don't know.
Right.
I still can't see the future. Who knows? But that is what it comes down to, is that, you know, it is fragile, and that's what makes it special, right?
Makes sense. It's just, it is hard to kind of fully grasp, I guess, certain, like, aspects of the characters in that way, where mm-hmm. they can be a personification of, like, absolute power. Like, we can look at it from that perspective, but it is also hard to, like, put ourselves kind of, like, I guess that's like kind of what we've been discussing. It's like, it's hard to really fathom that level of power, that level of choice, which mm-hmm. honestly is probably why it keeps getting explored in media over and over and over again, because it is kind of a, what would you do and who are you? What are your beliefs? What are your interpretation of the entire world and humanity and society and all that kind of stuff? So
exactly. It's all about where... It's all about where we're coming from. It's important to consider, I think, also that. Look, we could go on and on about this, guys, and I mean on and on and on. So let me, because this is probably one of the most fascinating conversations I've ever had the privilege to be a part of. So let me simply say, the idea is that you do have to make choices, and more importantly, that you are responsible for those choices that you make. You are responsible for the choices that you make, and that to me is the point of all of those characters, because despite mm-hmm. Veidt being... Lori and Dan are the normal human aspect, but... And Rorschach and the comedian are perhaps the violent human aspect of it. But Veidt and Manhattan are the two most aware human aspects. They know what the game is. They know how to play. Or at least they think that they know how to play. But they represent the farthest reaches of human beings. And they represent, you know, people thinking about those solid questions. They're not concerned with what they eat. They're not concerned with what they drink. They're not concerned with if they have to go to the bathroom, or if they want to watch a movie, or if they're going to go see Joker on Friday, or if they're going to do this, or if they're going to do that. They're not concerned with any of that. They are literally concerned with pushing the boundaries of who and what they are. And in some small way, I wish to close, at least for my part, with the idea that I think that Veidt and Manhattan represent not the artist, but the concept of art itself. Science and art are two sides of the same coin. Science and art are both trying to influence reality, one with facts and the other with fiction. What Watchmen will attempt to do, what every show attempts to do, what every DC show, what every Marvel show attempts to do, is to apply the emotional side of the science behind it. We can talk about the effects of climate change. We can talk about the minutiae of our day-to-day living. But ultimately, it is hundreds of people trying to influence the opinions of one single person. Just as I pointed out with Wendy. Ultimately, one person's single opinion on something is so powerful and they believe themselves to be so right that they think that they can influence somebody else. The trick is to self-actualize and recognize that you can have an opinion and not let it affect other people. And those opinions that affect other people can cause everything from all of the phobias and all of the isms and all of the attacks and all of the fear that exist within our society today. Or they can give people an avenue and an opportunity to fix things. The question on Veidt and Manhattan's minds is, how do you fix humanity? To me, the answer is that you don't. You do not fix what we are. If you believe in a higher power, then eventually the higher power may come and fix us. But to truly fix what we are, there is no one single solution, because there is no one single central opinion. As you watch the show and as you look at these characters, recognize that whatever you may think of them, your opinion is different than the people who wrote them and than the people who initially created them. Maybe. So as much as we... Wait, say what?
Maybe.
Maybe. But even then, yeah. Even then, all we can do is present you with the facts and give you an opportunity to consider it. And then you make up your own mind. And that is what will prevent people like Veidt, Manhattan, the comedian, Rorschach, and yeah, even Dan and Laurie to a point. That is what will prevent people from hurting. That is what will prevent people from pain. Is that you take the time to make up your own mind and do like Wendy's suggestion. How do you feel about it? How do you ask questions? So that's the whole point of what we're trying to do.
And that really is, I got in a lot of large discussion last week about, you know, the morality quote, you know, that it wasn't going to force feed people. I don't remember what the exact quote was, but something like it wasn't going to force feed people morality. But that's the beauty of watching. My father passed away quite some time ago, but he used to be a professor. And when he died, his students got up and talked about, you know, why he was so important to their lives. And the thing was, the way, you know, and what they would talk about is the way that he taught them was always to ask them the questions, to make them tell him the answer themselves, and that was the learning, you know, the way to learn was not it and that's it. Is Watchmen isn't saying, you know, isn't
XYZ is correct.
Yeah, so and so is good. You know, Darkseid is bad, and Superman is good, right? It's saying, I'm going to present you with some questions that are going to make you question the nature of reality, and what you think about the world. I'm not going to tell you what to think, and I think that this is clearly you. And you are correct. If you're telling someone what to think, it will never work. But what you need to do is to make them think. And I think that is the thing that I think we have one more episode before the show starts. But that is my hope for this show, is that it makes the world think about some of the things that are going on today that could very well, you know, cause the next apocalypse.
Right on.
Or many apocalypses.
So, Vanessa, Tony, what do you think about the idea of absolute power? And we can maybe close on that. Because otherwise we will talk forever.
I would say my thoughts on absolute power, I guess, I mean, people always ask the question of, you know, does absolute power corrupt? Absolutely. And I don't know if we ever got that answer. And I'm always going to come from everything from my life experiences. But at the end of the day, I disagree with Manhattan's we're all puppets, blah, 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 because I believe that we have free will to do anything and anything. And free will is everything. That is our power, period. And we choose to do what we do. We are, and we have to have that responsibility. There is no one, I don't think that there is, you know, like a preordained fate, destiny, you know, that sets us on a path. I do think that we meet certain people and do certain things and experience certain things for a reason, but I don't think there are strings or puppets pulling us. I find it fascinating that there is that option, because that takes a lot of choice out of your decisions, right? That makes it easier to live your life. But that also makes you a little bit lazy. And I don't know. I think that absolute power is, it's it's tempting. It's something that I've often thought about, and it would be cool to have the power to change and reshape the world the way I want to see it. That's also dangerous. And a lot of villains have said that me too. So it's probably good that I don't have that. But I think that it's something that is, again, something we should all think about. What would we do if we were in these people's positions? Because we always say we could do one thing or the other. When you really think about it, you don't really know. And half the time, I don't know. That's what I've been, this whole theme of this entire episode has just been, I don't know. The entire episode is me. I don't know. So that's where I'm at, guys. I don't know.
Okay. And then Tony?
I guess it's kind of, if you want to almost like get the fully like realization of absolute power in our society, at least, it would be like the Amazon guy. I cannot pronounce his last name. Jeff Bezos. Okay. Like, it'll be that kind of, you could really do anything without hurting yourself. And I mean, you know, I know that these rich people, they do charities and stuff like that, but they're still so ridiculously rich. And they don't do anything to, like, nothing visually significant to even inspire others to do the too well or anything like that. So I do wonder if you could almost look at it like that, where maybe like Vanessa was saying, absolute power, maybe it corrupts to a degree, at least like in our society, where you look at how the people who have the most power don't tend to generally act right. So maybe there is something where we are, I don't know, missing some kind of, I mean, I guess you could look at it from like self-preservation aspect. Okay, I want to protect what I have kind of thing, which is probably how most of them think about it, versus I'm going to not give my things to other people. But I guess like, it's almost kind of similar to that in a way, where Manhattan is kind of like the rich guy who has his wealth and has like all the power. And he's like, what if I do the wrong thing? Or I don't know. I guess for him, it's not necessarily about loss, but it is kind of a situation where he's looking at whether to interfere or if it is interference in a way. And I don't know. I guess it's just kind of, I'm pessimistic in that I know like people are good. There are plenty of good people, our families to the degree, that kind of thing. But I do wonder if human society as a whole is kind of, once you get to a certain level, you kind of lose a bit of something. I don't know. It's just kind of depressing, which is why I said, I wouldn't interfere if I had that kind of power. I don't know. Like, it just seems like.
And that's what original Thunderbolt Peter Cannon would have said. It's like, yeah, don't interfere with humanity's problems. Let them sort it out themselves. But he always did.
Yeah. That's the thing. I'm very helpful too, even in my little small context. I just try to do what I can. As I say,
sometimes that's all we can do. So next week, or in a week or so, what are we talking about, Wendy? My vote for next week is that we do the live action adaptation, or at least as much of the live action adaptation as we can, just to cover previous, or at least previous adaptations, the animated stuff.
I was gonna say we're gonna do a trailer breakdown at any point of the new stuff.
Yes, we can add that into there.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that was my only thing is, I would like to talk about the show more, a little bit more, the trailers at least.
So, you can email us if there's stuff that you thought we got wrong or that you didn't like what we said, go ahead and email us at watchmantvpodcast@gmail.com. You can post a comment on our website, watchmanpodcast.com. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can call us at 918-200-9103. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Watchmen Podcast. And on Twitter, you can find us at Watchmen Talk. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher Radio. And we always love it when you give us a rating and review and let us know how we're doing. Watchmen podcast is part of the DC TV podcast network. So if you are interested in other DC TV shows, you can check us out at Batwoman podcast, Black Lightning podcast, DC TV classics, DC's Legends of Tomorrow podcast, iZombie Radio, Krypton podcast, Stargirl podcast, Supergirl Radio, Swamp Thing Radio, and The Flash podcast. You can subscribe to DC TV podcasts on Apple Podcasts and follow DC TV podcasts on Twitter and like DC TV podcasts on Facebook. Until next time, tick tock, tick tock.